tá fáilte rót go dtíana orgá le an chat ar chinne go seachta ní an luan dearnach na mí baltana. This is Austin Cummerton on Chin 97.9 FM with another edition of the Gaelic Hour on this last Monday of the month of May. And as you remember when you were growing up, you'd hear, don't change a clout till May is out. Well, May will be out soon and maybe we can change finally into the t-shirts and shorts and leave them on. We have a full programme for you tonight and I'm looking forward to sharing it with you. I hope you enjoy it, that you sit down, you relax, you get the cup of tea and the scone, or you sit down, put the feet up. Because tonight, we're going to open with John P. Kelly, and John has a play opening at the Arts Court tomorrow night. It's called Iron, and it is by Rona Munro. That runs from tomorrow night to June 7th with a few little hiccups in the way it's done, and we'll tell you about that later in the programme. Also tonight, we're going to have some of the ladies from the Seniors Drop-In share some of the stories that they contributed to Memories of the Past, which are stories and recipes from the Ottawa Irish Drop-In Group. And they will be launching their book on June 8th at the National Irish Canadian Cultural Centre, which is at 314 Patrick Street, and that will be on Sunday, the 8th of June at about 1 p.m. There's a pancake breakfast down there that morning also from 10 until 1. So if you go down for the breakfast, you can stay on and then have a launching of Memories of the Past. And of course, tomorrow between 11 and 2, the group will be getting together as usual at St. Margaret Mary's at Sunnyside in Fairburn. And that's at 11 o'clock from 11 until 2. And the Ottawa Gaels, they're back in training. So on Wednesday evening at 6:30, they'll be out at Uplands Park. And they have their season, as I say, is getting underway. I do need to follow up with them to start bringing you the results of the games that they're playing. So we'll try and get time and get after some of the guys out there and do that. And this programme is brought to you in part by the generous sponsorship of the Irish Village Group of Companies. And if you're down around the market from any time, of course, but from Wednesday to Saturday, there's live music at night time in all of the pubs that are within the Irish Village Group, which include the Heart and Crown, Mother McGinty's, the Old Dubliner and the James Street Pub, and also the new Heart and Crown on Preston Street, a beautiful location. And on Saturday, the 7th of June, it's rugby time in the National Capital Region at the Twin Elm Rugby Park. England Saxons versus the US and Canada versus Scotland. And you get tickets from Ticketmaster, and that's 613-755-1111. And we are planning our June programmes, and Monday night next I will be broadcasting the interview by Marion Finucane with Nuala O'Fuilleann, and that was broadcast on RTE. Nuala O'Fuilleann died on May 9th, and she talked to Marion Finucane about her terminal cancer early in April, and it is a very, very moving interview indeed. And for those of you that were with Daniel O'Donnell tonight, I'm sure you had a fantastic night. If you do want to reach me, my email address is austin@thegaelichour.ca. The website is thegaelichour.ca. This programme is podcasted. It'll be available probably on Wednesday. On Tuesday, 27th of May, over at the Arts Court, John P. Kelly has a new play opening called Iron by Rona Munro, and it runs until June 7th. There's an additional performance on Saturday the 31st with a matinee at 2, and also a matinee on Sunday the 1st, but there's no evening production on the 1st, and of course the stage is black on Monday, June 2nd. John P. Kelly, welcome back to the Gaelic Hour.
Thank you, Austin. It's always great to be here with you.
John, tell us a little about this particular production.
Well, Iron by Rona Munro was first done at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in the year 2003. So it's quite a new play in terms of getting it here. It's 7:30 Productions' first non-Irish play. Actually makes me smile, because I remember shortly after I arrived here in Canada being introduced to someone in the Irish community as being, this is John, he's real Irish. I said, yeah, I'm real Irish, all right. Anyway, Iron is it could be called a psychological drama, it could be called a thriller. It's certainly twists in it from start to finish. It's set in a prison somewhere in Scotland. It's got some terrific female roles in it. We have some great performers, as usual, involved in this show. Margot MacDonald, Colleen Sutton, Kate Smith, Brian Stewart. That's now, I've mentioned them all to you now. And it's a great show, and I hope that you're all going to come and see it.
John, you say it's set in a prison, so usually a prison environment, there tends to be a lot of tension.
Well, there is a lot of tension in the play. There's a lot of tension in the play. I think if I had to be worried about selling this show, would be that when you tell people a show is set in a prison, what would worries me is that the image would be a very dull, dour, slow image, and it's anything but that. There's a lot of humour. There's a lot of laughter. There's also a lot of screaming. It's not the sort of show that you're going to be able to sit back and just say, isn't that nice? It's perhaps in some ways not so nice. But then a lot of the shows, 7:30s, people say, they're not nice shows. Well, I'm not a nice person, Austin.
I wouldn't say that. I just what was represented.
You would, Austin. Go on.
What's represented on stage is meant to be in some way an effort to capture some, I suppose, the intricacies of human life that we may not always be very aware of.
I think that's well put, Austin. I think, you know,
theatre is my life, and it always has been. And I want to be just entertained. I'm one of these guys. I want to be just sit back and be entertained. I'll go and see a Walt Disney film. You know, I want to be moved. I want to be made to think. I want to be made to feel in theatre. And this is one of those plays which makes me rethink the whole nature of the effect of long-term incarceration on a person. But at the same time, there is always in this play the question, what on earth actually happened? And it's a bit of a dun-dun-dun-dun image to it right through, which we will try, with the help of good actors and, of course, brilliant direction, to hold to the very end.
Rona Monroe, what can you tell us about
Rona? Rona Monroe is famous by now as a film, television writer, as well as stage, a Scottish person, grew up in Aberdeen, has done some, when you're doing the research on her, you find some interesting things. Like, you know, she's written 3 episodes of Doctor Who for BBC. This was a huge hit. It transferred immediately to London. She has, I believe, actually, I heard recently, I thought, you know, typical Kelly, I thought, you know, well, I'll be the first person to do a Rona Monroe play in Ottawa. No, apparently Tara have actually done a Rona Monroe play about 5 years back. Not this one, though.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to hear a little piece from the play that will give a flavour of what people can expect on stage. When we do listen to the little piece, what are we going to be focusing in on?
You're going to be listening to an early scene where a young woman of 25 meets her mother for the first time since she was 10 years old. Her mother has been in jail for the last 15 years, sentenced for the murder of the young person's father.
And who is in that role?
That will be Margo MacDonald playing the role of Faye, the mother, and Colleen Sutton playing the role of the daughter.
Excellent. Well, this is a little snippet from Iron by Rona Monroe, which, as I say, opens on the 27th over at the Arts Court and runs until June 7th, with the exception of Nothing on Monday, June 2nd, and an additional performance, or matinee performances, on Saturday the 31st and Sunday June 1st. And they're at 2 p.m.
That's it, Austin. Come along.
This isn't too bad, is it?
What isn't?
This place.
You think so, do you?
Well, I mean, there's flowers out there.
Eh?
Acres of them. Trees. Grass.
And do you see me skipping across it with a picnic basket? Well, they make it look good.
No, it's just not what I expected.
What did you expect?
Barbed wire. Rottweilers. I didn't expect geraniums.
It's not what you think. It's not a hotel.
I was joking. I'm sorry.
It's no joke.
Just more cheerful than I thought.
Well, there you go.
Well, that's good, isn't it?
What?
That you're not all locked up in iron bars and concrete.
I could see how you'd think that. This is a long time to sit without fag. What time is it?
You're listening to the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM.
On Sunday, June 8th at 1 o'clock, there's the launch of a book, and it is entitled Memories of the Past, and that will be at the National Irish Canadian Cultural Centre down at 314 St. Patrick Street in Ottawa. Tonight we're going to have 4 of the authors share their contributions. We're opening with Joan McKay and a poem, A Burden of Stones. And we'll follow that with Pat Marshall, and her story is Neither Fish Nor Fowl.
I was born in Canada, and my Celtic connections, both Scottish and Irish, came from my father's side of the family. So I made the reverse trip, which was one to Ireland, and this is a poem which came out of that visit. It's called The Burden of Stones. 1. A gull shivers across wet shoreline, its feet drawing hieroglyphics in the Sanskrit of birdland. The meaning should be clear to us, our larger brain able to master miniature codes, but imagination fails. As dawn eats holes in the darkness, bits of heart break off to feed a hunger we cannot define. Follow, follow me. A perfect cameo of sound springs from the small throat. Follow me. I know this coast, the topography of the Skelligs. I have seen the other world, Chir Jingira, home. I know the centuries of losses embedded here and which survive as the memory of flight survives a broken wing. Follow me. I am of the sea and air. Follow me. 2. Anchored to land, stone shifts in the receding tide, sinks a little deeper into the grasp of earth, fights the seductive warmth at earth's volcanic heart. Savage memories recall a previous birth, a giant mouth spitting out rock and ash like the wheels of a truck chewing up slate on the sides of the Balahura Mountains. I am stone. Choose me to carry with you. I will burrow into the hollow of your heart. I hold the sun and the night. I have weight. 3. My heart is a stone, abandoned on shore, the sea going on without it, mute, with no one to call its name. Ardpatrick, Oysterhaven, Belgooly, Cove. The naming is important, turning the nebulous into something we can touch, hold on to, a civil baptism, the sign of the cross etched below the surface of rock and skin, catching the light for a moment so brief we can believe we only imagined it. 4. The burden of stones and Ireland, the mind leaping inexplicably to the Count of Monte Cristo, sewn in his brown cloth sack, sinking like a stone. Entering the sea by choice, escape or death, two sides of the coin, like Ireland with its tears and stone crosses, escape or death, but no pity, only the wind in the sails keening.
We're so poor. Let's go to Canada, Les. We can go for 8 years and then come back and live like lords. No, Nora, I'm a bus driver now, and someday I'll get to be an inspector, and then I'll be making more than £3 a week. It was 1954 in Blackstone, smoggy Liverpool, Little Dublin, or the other Dublin, as it was also known. Dad's family had come from Dublin. My granddad was born on Grafton Street, and Mum's family came from Tullamore in Offaly. I was 9 and quite happy in Liverpool. I much preferred jam butties to meat any day and couldn't understand my mother's constant nagging about poverty and emigrating. I liked not having a bathroom because I didn't like having baths or getting washed. And besides, in cold weather, I didn't have to go to the lavatory outside. I got to use a metal bucket in front of the fire. At times, I did feel something of my mother's anxiety. "Come on, Pat," she said one day. "We're going to the pawn shop down the road with the wooden candlesticks." She went on to tell me that these were the last of her wedding presents. We wrapped them up and she hid them in her bag. I knew that we'd never see them again. Nothing that we took to the pawn shop was ever redeemed. On the way home, she bought bread and jam and eclair cakes. After dinner, my dad would always say, "Right, Nora, what's for afters?" And that night, there would be something. Whenever she had no money and there was a knock at the door, Mum wouldn't answer it in case it was the insurance man, and so I had to crawl into the empty front parlor, look through the net curtains, go back to the kitchen and tell her who was there. Sometimes it was the gypsies, with their colorful cases of lace and ribbons, but despite my protest, she would never open the door to them, nor would she let me go and see the caravans and horses that formed a circle on the waste ground over on the next street. Finally, Mum wore my dad down. It was when there were no more shillings for the electricity meter and not much coal in the shed. Dad rigged up a coil heater by using 2 pins and a wire, which he attached to the main wire before it reached the meter. Mum was very religious. I used to call her holy, and would not go near the stolen heat. Her dream in life was to have a cottage, she said, with roses growing outside the door. And so the conversation changed to where, Australia or Canada, and when we would emigrate. I was very excited when they chose Canada because at school we'd learned about wheat fields full of cowboys and Indians. We went to the Canadian Immigration Office and had to show our vaccination marks to a doctor. As mine was under my foot, I felt awkward showing the sole of my left foot when everyone else just stuck out their arms. I was then given a little suitcase in which I packed my cloth clown Joey, my gollywog Sambo, Bunny, and a few other beloved treasures. Teddy would travel in my arms. Finally, the departure was just a few days away, and we were staying with friends when Dad got a letter saying that he couldn't go because he had a shadow on his lung. Dad was a chain smoker. I would help him to roll his ciggies. I got to use the roller after he packed the tobacco in and then lick the sticky bit on the white tissue paper. 3 weeks later, after another x-ray, he was cleared. But as there were no departures from Liverpool, we had to leave the Great Port behind us and take the boat train to Southampton, where we boarded the HMS Cimmeria, a Cunard liner that had been used as a troop ship during the war. Well, talk about feeling like a princess. I had never known such luxury. The cabin was warm, and so you didn't need a hot water bottle and your dad's great coat over you in the bunk beds. There were sweets and little cakes called fondants, and the other passengers were very friendly until they got seasick and then disappeared for the rest of the voyage. My dad and I would stand at the stern and watch the rise and fall of the ship and the long wake tumble off into the distance. It was February, and a huge storm was in the offing. The captain announced that he was going to slow down rather than sail into it. In the end, this added several days on this floating magical city, and I was delighted. I had seen sunsets that were reflected all around, unlike anything in Liverpool, and a night sky of stars without end. On day 9, we landed in Halifax, but for some reason unknown to me, we stayed on board and debarked in New York 2 days later on the 2nd of March. I cried and wanted to stay forever on the ship. Memories of the processing have faded, and we probably went through Ellis Island. I do recall going on a bus to a train station with our heavy cases. We got on and sat down, thinking that there would be a conductor to take the fares. The bus driver shouted and swore at my father, and I was so hurt. We arrived at the train station where Dad left Mum and me with our pile of luggage while he went to find out where to take the train to Toronto. He seemed to be away for ages, and we were getting anxious. But finally he returned. We were at the wrong station and had to lug everything back into another bus, and this time he paid up front. Toronto was a huge disappointment to me. There was not a cowboy or Indian in sight, and I was feeling very badly done by. Life was very hard on my parents during those first years. My dad wanted to go home, but Mum was too proud to go back worse off and to have to pay back the passage to the government. Then, by the time she decided that she was ready to go back, Dad no longer had his bus driver's job available in Liverpool, and so we stayed. My mother lived in her own world and pined for everything, her family, the small shops, the food. Nothing in Canada tasted the same, bananas, tomatoes, milk, except HP sauce. And she even missed the things she used to complain about, such as coal fires, forgetting about chilblains, cold backs, and the soot falling down the chimney every so often. Dad used to sing to her, "I'll take you home again, Kathleen," and this just made her worse. Thus, another family of immigrants, following in the footsteps of their Irish parents, broke away and tried to re-root in foreign soil. Their roots never quite took. In 1978, they returned, but it was too late. Their Liverpool was no more. And so, in 1980, they once again crossed the Atlantic to Canada. I'm all right here, but felt that I was neither fish nor fowl, neither Irish, English, nor Canadian. Blood is thick, and Irish blood pulls you back to your roots. I've been there, I've seen the beauty, and tried the language, and felt at home. Now my fingers roam the harp strings and discover the magic. If I could find me a handsome boatman to carry me over to my deep heart's core. Carrickfergus, only for nights
in Ballygrand. I once swam over the deepest ocean, the deepest ocean, from my love to find. But the sea's wide, and I cannot swim over, neither have I the wings to fly. If I could find me a handsome boatman to ferry me over to my love and death. My childhood days bring back sad reflections of happy times spent so long ago. My childhood friends and my own relations have all passed on now like melting snow. But I've spent that long road down to the sea. I'll spend my days in endless robbery, the peaceful grove, my bed is free. But I and my days are numbered. Come all you young men. And lay.
Fergus from Celtic Woman, and you may have noticed that the words in that were what Pat Marshall had used to finish her story. If I could find me a handsome boatman to carry me over to my deep heart's core. We'll be back after these messages.
Big Brothers Big Sisters is an organization that focuses on matching young kids with positive adult role models. The little brothers and little sisters in our program are between the ages of 6 and 18. Our adult volunteers are over 18 and have been thoroughly screened. Through our programs, we strive to give little brothers and little sisters the chance to build positive relationships with their big brother or big sister. Together, they are able to share similar interests and engage in fun activities. If you are interested in a role model for your child or are interested in becoming a volunteer, please call Big Brothers Big Sisters Ottawa at 613-247-4776, extension 315 or 309, or visit our website at www.bbbso.ca.
One man set himself the task 10 years ago of recording some of the old ways of farming that have virtually disappeared in his own lifetime. Michael Lyons from the parish of Taghmaconnell in South Roscommon.
This is the parish of Taghmaconnell in South Roscommon. I was born here. In the late 40s, my father was farming and out working for hire with horses, cutting hay and corn. At that time, most of the work on the farm was done by horses, except for the thrashing, which was done by either steam or tractor. In the early 50s, the tractor became more popular and the horse started to disappear off the land. My father taught me the old ways of farming, and this video shows some of these old ways, as well as the transition from horse to tractor and other aspects of life in rural Ireland at that time.
If
purchase your copy of the Old Ireland DVD, visit www.thegaelichhour.ca and follow the links.
Little Irish Village, with the heart and crown, is the ideal place to find a good pint in a warm atmosphere, a snug pub, cosy, well-appointed alehouse with an inviting fireplace, and intimate coves for small groups. Mother McGinty's and Roisin Dubh, the Black Rose, complete the Irish Village. Sit on the patio, enjoy the buzz of the market. If it's a planned party or a casual visit, the Irish Village is the ideal spot. Music, food and drink in a welcoming atmosphere. It can only be the Irish Village.
Welcome back to the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM, and we're going to continue with Mary Coffey reading her contribution to the Irish Society Seniors Drop-In publication, Memories of the Past, which is due to be launched down at the National Irish Canadian Cultural Centre on St. Patrick Street, and that is on Sunday, June 8th at 1 p.m.
I was born in a small thatched house on Monument Hill outside Westport, County Mayo. What a beautiful view we had. On one side, Clew Bay and majestic Kirkpatrick. On the other, Nathan Moor and Nathan Beag. And down below us, the town of Westport. There were only two in our family, my brother and I. My father worked in construction in Swansea and later in Dublin, so we seldom saw him. He died in Dublin when I was 12. My mother was a widow for 42 years, a lonely life for her. But of course, we, as children, didn't recognize it at the time. We had few of life's luxuries, no electricity, no running water. I did my homework by the light of an oil lamp. My mother cooked and baked by the hearth fire. A simple life, but a carefree and happy one. My brother and I attended the local schools, I the convent and he the Christian Brothers. The nuns were very good teachers, but very strict. One day I made a mistake in my copybook, and I got so many wallops of the pointer that I went down like a log, almost pulling off a girl's skirt in the process. Panic ensued, but it's an ill wind. From that day on, the pointer was locked away, much to our delight. From there, I went to the Sacred Heart School, and I must say I enjoyed every minute of the 5 years I spent there. The high school was situated on the banks of the Carabag River, in spacious grounds and lovely wooded areas. Often in summertime, we had classes outside, beside the sparkling, gurgling waters. My friends and I were happy with very simple pleasures, walking, cycling, swimming, visiting in the evenings, sitting by the hearth fire, talking, listening to music, singing our favorite songs, and loath to leave the ticking clock and shining bells. One of the highlights of my teenage years was an annual holiday to Dublin to visit my Aunt Molly. What an enormous and exciting change from a small cottage and a quiet town to a big bustling city, a house with all modern conveniences and an altogether new way of life. The magic of Woolworths, the splendour of the Dublin Horse Show, where I bought penny pots of jam to bring home to my friends, the wonders of the Dublin Zoo, the street vendors, the music, and the endless traffic were all new and enchanting discoveries to a country girl like myself. Dublin will always remain one of my favourite places. In 1943, I successfully wrote an exam for a position in the post office. I did my leaving certificate in June, and in August left home to work as a learner in Mullingar Post Office. There I was initiated into the mysteries of the Morse code, the telephone exchange, the sorting office and the counter, stamps, postal orders, pensions, savings accounts, etc. One day the postmaster came into the telegraph office and was horrified to find a learner, me, sending messages to Dublin in Morse code, unheard of. As a learner, I was paid 17 shillings a week. My digs were 28 shillings, so my mother and a cousin supplemented my meagre income. However, in October I turned 18, and my pay jumped to 39 shillings and sixpence, untold wealth. I was delighted to tell the good news to my mother, who could ill afford to help me. I have very happy memories of my time in Mullingar.
Okay, if you want to pause, I'll pause.
Okay.
My
training as a learner completed, I was transferred to Roscommon Post Office and spent a reasonably happy time there. I say reasonably because the postmaster, for some reason, felt I was sent there to try his patience, which was in short supply to begin with. His quarters were the other side of the telegraph office door, to which I'm sure he had his ear glued whenever he was off duty. In 1946, I applied for a transfer to Westport, my hometown, where I met my husband-to-be then. I worked there until 1952, when I left to get married. At that time, a woman couldn't retain her job when she married, so I left with a princely severance pay of £120. Ben, meanwhile, had left the post office to establish a new post office union, the Post Office Clerical Association, with headquarters in Dublin. So after a very happy, carefree honeymoon in beautiful Cork, we headed for Dublin to take up residence in a lovely flat in Rathmines, our first home. We spent three exciting, happy years in Dublin. Exciting because of Ben's new job, the arrival of Paul in 1953 and Anne in 1954, and happy adjusting to city life, making new friends and having lots of visitors, my mother's and Ben's, for example. But then, lured by glowing tales from friends who had emigrated to Canada, Ben decided to follow their example and sailed from Cove on June 13th, 1955. I followed months later with Paul, 2½, and Anne, 1 year old. I remember sitting in the tender, crying bitterly, while two frightened children clung desperately to me as the coast of Ireland and the beautiful view of Cove receded into the ever-growing distance. As we entered the huge liner, the band played McNamara's Band, which did nothing to assuage my wretchedness. The voyage was partly nightmare due to seasickness and partly fun, with Bingo at night and new acquaintances to meet. After 10 days, we arrived in New York and spent the whole day at Grand Central Station, awaiting the overnight train to Toronto. From the train, the landscape looks dark and forlorn, snow-covered and bleak. Finally, we arrived to be met by a very excited Ben, who, after he had proudly shown us our new home, a lovely flat, announced he was taking us downtown to watch the Santa Claus parade. So began our new life, with its ups and downs, joys and sorrows, and many blessings in a strange and wonderful country. There is much I have left unsaid. I have gathered many wonderful friends over the years, from school days, from post office days, and from the early married life days, I have been truly blessed. Thank God.
It's many years ago now since I left my Mayo home, searching for those green hills somewhere across the foam. But I was young and foolish, and I longed for city lights, away from my Clare Island and its lovely scenic sights. Somewhere along life's highway, that dream began to die, like waves out on the ocean, tears went rolling by. And tonight I'm reminiscing about my old home in Mayo. I see the lights of Westport in the gloaming long ago. A heart so full of memories can never be at rest. I recall a girl I knew long, long ago. And late at night when all is still and the moon peeps o'er the hills, I dream about my old home in Mayo. How I would love to walk once more near the castle by the quay, and watch the golden sunset upon the western sea, or stroll along the mountain path beneath the harvest moon, a few miles out from Lewisburg on the road to Killadoon. Someday I'll go back again to my old home in the west, where Atlantic waters cradle the place that I love best. And the girl from lovely Westport is a memory now, I guess. But the yearning deep inside me doesn't make the hurting less. A heart so full of memories can never be at rest. I recall a girl I knew long, long ago. Late at night when all is still and the moon peeps o'er the hill, I dream about my old home in Mayo. Late at night when all is still and the moon peeps o'er the hill, I dream about my old home in Mayo.
Tune into the Gaelic Hour, Chin 97.9 FM.
That was Old Home in Mayo with Mick Flavin. And we're continuing on in Mayo, and Bridget Guglidge's contribution to Memories of the Past is entitled Leaving Home and Finding It Again. Here's Bridget.
It is hard to tell when the knowledge of my certainty that I would have to leave home when I grew up became a part of my childhood ponderings. I do remember very clearly spending hours lying on a bed after school when I was about 8 or 9, considering how to prevent this calamity. When I say home, it means the total world I knew. Home has ever been Ballycroy in County Mayo. One strategy I used was to pair off boys and girls in the parish and randomly assign them to a farm. There were always a huge surplus of landless, whom I immediately recognised as the future immigrants to far-off lands. No matter how I tried to fix the numbers, the results were the same. Being the third child in a large family, I recognised that I would be on the immigrant list. No doubt this worry and preoccupation was the result of my well-honed observations of the scourge of immigration at close quarters. The comings and goings of seasonal farm workers to England and Scotland was part of everyday life in those years. Then there were the more permanent departures to America, England and occasionally Australia. These were marked by enormous grief, which enveloped all family and friends when a departure was imminent and lasted perhaps forever. One of my earliest memories is of a group of young ladies, one of them my aunt, trying on lipstick while they laughed at my mother's chidings. They were going to a dance at dusk. I do not recall ever seeing my Aunt Mary again. She died in London 9 months after going there on November 19, 1939. The tears shed in our home during those bleak November days when relatives and friends came to offer sympathy left a profound impression. Another early memory is watching my Uncle Pat walk out the road at dawn with a small cotton or canvas bag. He carried all he owned and a bit of food in that little bag. As the years passed, I learned about other relatives who were absent and missed. We would get letters with an occasional picture of the children from England and America. These would be studied for family resemblance. Many children were returned to the parish by parents during the war years to avoid the Blitz. This offered a glimpse of a big world beyond Ballycroy, as accents, clothes and news were studied. When I was 13, I was given the opportunity to attend high school in Achill Sound. This was a miracle because I loved school and we could not afford the boarding schools at that time. The miracle was brought about by the generosity and courage of the founder of Skaldownit, Mr. Pádraig Sweeney. He successfully opened the first secular co-ed school in Ireland in spite of opposition from clergy in September 1948. It was a day school and much needed for the children of the area who would otherwise finish school at 14. The other part of the miracle was that I was given room and board with an equally generous couple, the O'Sullivans, in exchange for household help and care of their growing family. The 4 years spent at Skaldownit and living with the O'Sullivans exposed me to a different life from the one I was familiar with in Ballycroy. I now had a bicycle to get me to school. Mr. O'Sullivan was the pension officer for the whole region. He had a car and his work, which sometimes took him to Ballycroy and all over Achill Island and Corran and Mulrannie in Newport. He often had good stories to tell about detecting some irregularities between his assessment and the claims made by the poor people. He also had an office in the house where he worked when not travelling. I was there from 1948 to 1952, and I'm forever grateful for those miracles, which allowed me to obtain my high school leaving certificate. Mrs. O'Sullivan was a nurse who, as was the custom, no longer practiced. She was a native of Corran and also had great stories about growing up there with a seafaring father and about life in Dublin, where she trained and worked. In those 4 years, I also got to know the different parts of Achill, and I remember those villages with the same affection as the ones in Ballycroy. I love the strong headwinds which I faced almost daily cycling to school from Pádraig to Achill Sound. At school, I made friends with children from all over Achill, learning the names of their different villages. Places in Achill such as Dugar, Duige, Shraheens became as familiar to me as Drumgala, Seanamonra, and Dereal in Ballycroy. It is amazing to me that I can recall the smells and every visual detail of those places as they were then, but now are changed forever by more modern housing, cars and general improvements which have accompanied the economic conditions. The challenge of finding work after I finished school at age 17 was solved by another stroke of luck when a teaching position was vacated on the island of Inishbeagle by a cousin of my mother's. All I had to do was apply, and as there was no competition, the job was mine. This became another adventure. From Sunday evening to Friday evening during the year, I spent in isolation, except for the company of children and the old lady from whom I rented a room. In that year, I developed a love of reading, self-sufficiency, and a lot of courage. The courage was necessary to attempt teaching about 15 to 20 youngsters aged 4 to 15, without formal training or direction from the Department of Education. The neglect of the West by the comfortable politicians in Dublin was very apparent by the end of the year. And so, the old pastime of trying to find a way to avoid leaving home was again a major preoccupation. Reality and choices were checked mentally as a daily exercise. I was no Peg Sayers, and I was no match for the rigours of the dangerous boat trip from Talla to Inishbeagle every week. It was lonely because no young people lived on the island. So the decision to abandon the post was made because I recognised that qualifications and credentials would become important. This was a painful decision because it shattered my parents' dream of seeing their children find jobs in Ireland, having received an education which had been denied them. My family now numbered 13, with the older ones already out of the house. My older sister and brother were already in England, and the next sister in Belmullet, where she was staying with relatives and doing as I had done in exchange for room and board while she attended high school. The next one to her had joined me in Achill after 2 years and was still there. The friends from national school were all away in America or England. So it was London and nursing for me in the autumn of 1953. Whittington Hospital in Highgate, North London, was a big change from Ballycroy, Achill or Belmullet. The structures of nurses' training in those days is a story in itself. Soon I was feeling at home with this self-contained world where many Irish girls were in training. There were also some Irish women in senior positions at the hospital, and this had a stabilising influence in the new social environment in which hundreds of young Irish girls found themselves. St. Joseph's Church was another anchor where we found comfort in the familiar. So within a year there were new friends and a whole new world to explore. What we chose to explore was often the familiar, which meant that we went to different Irish dance halls and churches where one always recognised fellow expatriates. I did not realise then that we were a vital part of a large Irish ghetto. Notices publicly displayed in advertisements for rooms or jobs frequently stated that no blacks or Irish need apply. While these were offensive and shaming, they were never discussed. We somehow managed to ignore the slurs and continue working and succeeding. There were, of course, some Caribbean and African nurses in training, and I now wish I had possessed the courage to ask them how they felt. The highlight of each year was the annual four-week holiday when we went home. We got to know every facet of the well-oiled machinery of transportation which aided migration. Cheap fares and schedules kept the hospitals, factories, and all aspects of British industry supplied with willing workers in those post-war years. We got to know the rules of arriving at Euston Station in good time to get a seat on the train, transfer at Holyhead for the boat ride to Dunleary, then get to Westland Row for the beautiful journey to Westport. The welcome figure of the CIE ticket taker, who had a warm smile for everybody, marked the return home where language was again easy and there was no big hurry. Once on the train, we could relax and enjoy the wonderful Irish breakfast, which was anticipated since leaving Euston Station. The bacon, sausage, eggs, black pudding, Irish soda bread with butter and thick marmalade, served with great tea, were a treat after the stodgy hospital food with which we had to contend. The 3 years of general nurses training and 1 year of a specialty quickly passed, then followed working as a trained nurse with all the responsibility involved. A wide world of opportunity was open to nurses who could go anywhere in the English-speaking world and work, everywhere except home. Ireland could not possibly hire all the qualified young women who had left to become nurses. It took me a while to realise that again the numbers were not going to add up. I started to check what the various countries were offering to qualified nurses during the gloomy November days of 1960. Australia was tempting. £10 sterling would get me there with a job waiting. South Africa and Lebanon presented very attractive offers, but I did not seriously consider them. I chose Canada probably because I knew some of the history of the coffin ships and the efforts made by the French Canadian population to assist and assimilate the destitute as they arrived in Quebec by the St. Lawrence. I also knew that the population of Canada was over 50% Roman Catholic. The efficiency of the staff at Canada House in London impressed me. All I had to do was to be interviewed by an immigration officer who was female, pass a medical examination, follow the instructions regarding licensing in the province of Quebec, apply for a job from the list of hospitals provided, and save some money for the fare to last until I settled in Montreal. I was clear to come in 6 to 8 weeks after making the application for landed immigrant status in Canada. I had a job at the Montreal General Hospital and 2 weeks accommodation in a residence to allow me to find a suitable place to live. I decided to wait until the snow was gone and set my departure date for April the 11th, 1961. All this was accomplished in the days before fax machines, emails, and other modern communication systems. All I had to do when I arrived in Montreal was to present myself with my credentials and $10 at the Association of Nurses of the Province of Quebec and obtain my license to practice as a registered nurse. The address and phone numbers had been provided to me at Canada House in London. Again, I witnessed the well-oiled machinery of dealing with needed workers. Free French languages were also provided for anyone wishing to attend. Unfortunately, a nurse's schedule played havoc, and this I could not maintain the attendance. I arrived at Dorval Airport on April 11, 1961, on a Trans-Canada airline flight from London. The passenger ships were still plying the oceans with immigrants, but the airlines were offering competitive airfare, and so in the space of a day, I was on a different continent. I was also in a different culture, but yet it was somehow familiar. There was a vast difference between working and living in Montreal and London. The Montreal General Hospital was new, beautifully designed, the premier hospital in Canada at the time. It catered to the Anglo population and was closely associated with McGill University. The level of comfort in all aspects of life was so superior to what I was accustomed to that I could not believe my good fortune. I thought I had landed in heaven. Soon the social scene and new friends with various interests and contacts in the city led to a wider circle of friends and deeper knowledge of the aspirations of the people of Quebec. I recognized the parallels between the French-Canadian population struggling to keep its language in the milieu dominated by the powerful bastions of English wealth and power, and what was the history of Ireland. In the turmoil of the separatist endeavor for identity and self-government, individual pursuits and self-interest again prevailed, with friends departing from Montreal as the Anglo exodus took hold. I left Montreal for Sudbury in June 1965 with my new husband. To say that this was a serious shock to my psyche is an understatement. The scarred landscape, the slag heaps, the Copper Cliff smelter with its tall chimney spewing smoke day and night were not welcome environmental trappings. The absence of a park to take my baby for a walk in fresh air was difficult, as was living in a high-rise apartment, far from any amenities. After 2 years, my husband got a transfer to Ottawa. This was a joy, as I now could set about creating a home. We bought our first home in 1968, a semi-detached, two-story, well-laid-out, four-bedroom home for $21,500. So Ottawa became home, but not without the pull and need to find the familiar. While embracing the beauty and challenges of this vast new homeland, the family ties and the landscapes of West Mayo were ever present in day-to-day life, often stirred by a letter, a smell, or a sound. Fortunately, there has been a strong Irish history and a vibrant community in Ottawa, which fills some need to be with one's own people. Integration and raising two Canadian children brought home the reality that this was now home. I was hit with a bout of homesickness, which was so painful I thought I could die. There was no cure but to accept reality and broaden my knowledge of this land, so different yet so similar to the one I had to leave. I devoted myself to the study of Canadian history and found much to love in a land which welcomed willing new citizens. Now in retirement, I find I never really left home. I somehow managed to build and blend with what I found here and what I brought with me. The yearnings for home where we could not mature drives the need to connect with the familiar. While attending Irish language weekends and regular classes, going to the Irish seniors drop-in, trying to save St. Bridget's Church, signing petitions to have a footbridge named the Corktown Bridge, or attending sessions and Cayleys, where great traditional music is played, I am with the sounds of Ireland and all that is familiar. I am home at last.
You've been listening to the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Cumberton. I do hope you've enjoyed tonight's programme. It'll be available on the internet later in the week as a podcast, as are all the previous programs. In addition, there's a playlist up there listing the music that we use tonight. And tomorrow night, it's a night of music. And for those of you that may be coming home from Daniel O'Donnell's concert, I hope you had a wonderful night out there. And I want to express my thanks to the Irish Village Group of Companies for their continued support of the Gaelic Hour. So until tomorrow night, this is Austin Cummerton saying, Slán go fóill.